Welcome to Butterflies and Bravery. I am Jemima, and I'm here with my dear co-host, Whisper, who has a cough today.
And yesterday and the day before, and probably tomorrow too.
Poor thing. She hasn't had a cough forever, so now all the coughs for the last 10 years are catching up to her and giving her a big bomb cough.
I'm pretty sure I probably did pick it up in the hospital. I had a bit of a rough week last week because we didn't put out an episode last week. Yeah.
Yes. Because Whisper was in the hospital.
I was in the hospital and
doubled over in pain and then consequently drugged up. Yes. You were pretty loopy when I called you.
As soon as they knew what I had, they went straight to the Dilaudid.
Yeah.
And I was looking it up and it's way stronger than even morphine. And I've always thought that morphine was like the strongest painkiller. That shit, like, man. But yes, I survived yet another stint in the hospital. My body trying to kill me.
Pancreatitis, is that what the official diagnosis was?
Yeah, but just like the last time I had it, they believed it was a complication from a surgery. But they did the same thing, all the tests, and nothing's showing up, like, inflamed. Never ran a fever. They've actually diagnosed it based on my blood. And the first time I had it, they told me I had like high white count, really high white count. And this time I had really high lipates. But they did an ultrasound. They did a CAT scan. They did an MRI. And the doctor, he's the doctor of internal medicine. Which I always thought that was funny, even as a kid. Internal medicine. Isn't all of medicine internal?
Topical.
And he was like, yeah, your scans are showing nothing. Your pancreas, your liver, everything's healthy. So I'm one of the 15% of people that, I forget the word for it, but it's basically undiagnosed. No reason whatsoever. And I'm likely it could have to do with 20 years of basically being a prisoner of war.
Yeah, exactly.
That could probably be what it might be.
Today, we're going to talk about a study that was done by Polaris.
Yes, it's called the PolarisProject.org. They are the organization that manages and runs the National Trafficking Hotline Service here in the United States. It's an 800 number, a free number that anyone can call to ask for help or report trafficking. And in the human trafficking world, a lot of the data that gets processed or that gets looked at tends to come from that hotline because they're getting the calls from everywhere. We talked about the need for programs, the need for help, the need for support for survivors. And because I work in a nonprofit anti-human trafficking organization, we work with survivors of the more quote unquote traditional type of trafficking that people think of. Most people think of sex trafficking, but there's also labor trafficking. There's organ trafficking. I guess in our case, you would call it cult trafficking. So what Polaris did is, over the course of a year and a half, actually, they gathered survivors of human trafficking, both labor and sex trafficking, and did research and surveys for as many survivors as they possibly could. It was a word of mouth project, so as far as, is it all encompassing? Yes and no, because not everybody knows about the National Trafficking Hotline and the Polaris Project, but the people who do know, who have been out of trafficking, do know. They ended up with almost 500 survivors that participated in the survey. And it's to date the largest and most significant report that's ever been done on what are the needs of the survivors of human trafficking. And in doing my work and going through it, when I pull down the report, I'm looking at the responses and their key findings. And I don't think that there's any thing that runs as close to our experience than trafficking survivors, because you have prisoners of war. But as far as starting life over, it runs very close in parallel, because these survivors, when they get out, they're out on the street. It's not like there's programs for them to give them housing or have jobs lined up for them. Nope, nothing. Stop trafficking. So then go figure out what you're supposed to do now without any help. So the need has been very big. And in reading through the stats and the findings that they had, most of the study came back very similar to us, like what our greatest needs are. What the greatest needs are: mental health, financial literacy, or help with getting out of debt, education, job searches, that sort of thing. There was almost no one who said, yes, this program helped me get out. Nope. They got themselves out. What was interesting about this is it makes it very clear that the real fight for human trafficking, if we're going to talk just straight up human trafficking in the United States, the issues, or anywhere in the world, actually, the issues of human trafficking alone, not having to do with us as a cult, not having to do with anything else, just the labor and sex trafficking, human trafficking, 80% of the programs are set up for the rescue missions, like getting the people out. But the truest vulnerabilities are the before and the directly after. Very much like us.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to go and be the rescuer because that's flashy. And I'm your knight on the white horse riding in to save you. Like, that's, everybody loves it. Save the children, blah, 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 blah. But the percentage of kids that are trafficked by their own families is more than half. Well, more than half. Well, more than half. I mean, it's like they just keep putting band-aids on band-aids on band-aids on band-aids and are not treating the infection whatsoever. And I feel like that's a similar situation that we have when we walk out into the world of, we're just slapping band-aids all over ourselves, trying to cover up the places that we're wounded. And at the same time, trying to figure out how to treat the infection. The devastating numbers from this report were things like employment status. The annual household income in the United States, 26% of the general population sits at less than $25,000 a year of income. And this is household income, by the way, which is poverty. That's, what is that, $2,000 a month? So 26% of the general American public get less than $25,000 of income a year. But of human trafficking survivors, 43%.
Wow.
Once they're back out into the workforce and back out into the regular employment status, 43% are making less than $25,000.
Wow.
A year. When you jump up to the next tax bracket from $25,000 for income between $25,000 and $50,000 a year, 16% of the population fall into that. And only 30% of survivors. So you're seeing, like, on the low end, right, 25,000, you got 26 versus 43, way, way more that are under 25. Then you go to the next block up, right, 16% of the nation is making that income, but still 30% of human trafficking survivors are making that. But the next jump you make, everything shifts. And from 50,000 to 100,000 a year, 25% of the population make that much, which is actually a lot, but only 21% of human trafficking survivors do. And then for $100,000 or more, and this is household income, for $100,000 or more a year, which is frankly what you need to get by sometimes in the United States, is 32% of the population make that, and only 6% of human trafficking survivors do. So the disparity in that is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
In my work, in the job that I do, this is what gets discouraging for me, because we are trying to help get these survivors back into the workforce, or into the workforce for the first time, depending on whatever their situation is. But there's a lot of stigma around it. And I think this is where we divide a little bit from what human trafficking survivors are dealing with, labor trafficking, sex trafficking, and then cult trafficking. Of that 43% of survivors who are making under 25,000, within the first 2 years of them getting out, 70% of survivors are making that. So for the first 2 years of getting out of their trafficking situation, 70% of these survivors are making under 25,000 a year. And if they've gotten out over 7 years ago, 29% are still making $25,000 a year. So that's, what do you call it, like the poverty wheel. It just keeps going around and around. And these people, to stand strong and not go back into a work that, even though you were being exploited, gave you money, that takes a lot of strength to sit there for 7 years at $25K a year. But that's, I think, where things are a little bit different for us, because I've never done the demographic in the cult, but the majority of cult ex members that I know of are, majority of us are white. Would you say anecdotally? We have that privilege, and then we don't necessarily have that stigma attached to it. It's like wearing the scarlet letter, right? In general, the world sees you as one way as soon as you say you're a survivor.
Yeah. That's why some people never tell anybody, I guess, right?
Yeah. And then we get stuck back in perpetrating the whole sordid story over again because we're not talking about it. We shame the victims. We shame the survivors.
Yeah.
And who knows solutions better than the survivors themselves? So by shaming survivors, we're compounding the problem, trying to silence people. And that is something that we deal with a lot as ex-cult kids, is that shame them into silence. Sometimes it comes from within our own community, the whole, like, why don't you just get over it, kind of a silencing. Or sometimes it can come from our family and a lot of people that are like, don't rock the boat. But the things that start leaking out in your life when you do this, that you're going to end up paying for it in the long run, one way or another.
It reminds me of what Brené Brown said. If you don't spend a reasonable amount of time dealing with your emotions, you're going to spend an unreasonable amount of time picking up the pieces. Right?
Yeah.
I thought that was like, oh yeah, actually that's a very good. And it's the same thing, yeah. Right? Spend a reasonable amount of time.
And again, this is where I think we do differ, because we come out dropped into a place that we don't know and have to figure out our own way to thrive and rebuild ourselves, basically. But this kind of goes back a little bit to what we talked about on this podcast before, of what makes some abused children take certain directions in their life. And then what are those ingredients that can point them in one direction or another?
In Idaho, they have this thing called the Idaho Industrial Commission. And they basically check that workers' comp and everybody is doing their job, apparently. So okay. The lady comes over here and then asks me a bunch of questions and then goes to my workplace and asks them a bunch of questions and then talks to workers' comp. When the lady was here, was talking to her about my cult stuff a little bit. And she said that when she was in school for her dissertation, she did a study on that exact same thing. Why some kids turn into abusers and why others become more kind and empathetic and whatnot. And it came out, she has said the exact same thing that we said, was it has to totally to depend on who you relate to, whether you relate more to the abuser or whether you relate more to other people. So I thought it was interesting that she did the study and came up with the same conclusion. Yeah. I was like, yep, that's interesting. And it shows too, from our experiences, a lot of people that were removed from others or the oldest child and then a bunch came younger, those were the ones that tended to relate more to their abusers and the adults instead of the protectors like what a lot of us became.
Yeah, even kids that have come out of the long-term foster care situations where they've been together for long periods of time, they end up, unfortunately, in the juvenile system because of poverty. But as far as the protective side of things, yes, very similar thing too. They usually tend to try to protect other people. It is interesting.
Yeah.
Because the stats from the human trafficking report are really, really bleak. So here in the United States, there's this thing called ACEs. ACE, and it stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, and it's 10 different types of things that could happen, basically 10 horrible things that you had to deal with as a child. And a lot of health professionals and even medical doctors will ask someone about their childhood and to fill in the ACEs. And the higher number of ACEs that you have, supposedly, the more likely you are to have all these problematic things. I know I've gone through the ACEs and I have all 10 of them.
Me too.
Probably a lot of us can say that. And again, I keep going back to that. We're just like a whole new fucking breed. We're just a new breed of people. So the human trafficking survivors, when they asked them about their ACEs, 83% of them lived in poverty. 96% of them dealt with abuse, physical, sexual, and emotional. 93% of them had drug abuse or mental health issues in the home. 93% of them had another family or household instability. So the numbers on there, they don't give the percentage for all 10 of the ACEs, but then the numbers on there are just like incredibly high for that. And it's very easy to look at that outcome and say, this is what you're destined for.
Yeah.
Another big funnel into the human trafficking world, unfortunately, is the juvenile justice system.
Yeah.
And the child protective services or foster care. The percentage are in the 80s and 90s of the kids who were either fostered or in the juvenile justice system. And the thing that's interesting about that is there's some conversations or some talk in different arenas about the TTI, right? So TTI is troubled teen institutions, and there were these camps, right, that kids would get sent off for months to years at a time that were just horribly abusive in every single way. And they were also being trafficked. And again, it goes back to the coercion. How do we take this information and create laws, create, you know, safeguards, create labels so that there's a place to go to ask for help, whether it's the after help or the help getting out, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
These are the top 10 needs in ascending order of survivors when they first got out, when they very first exited. The number one was accessing behavioral or mental health services with providers that understand my trauma.
Yeah.
Sound familiar? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Two was finding people I trust that care about me and could help me. Three, finding a safe place to stay. Four, getting a stable living wage job. Five, getting a job that is a good fit for me. Six, accessing a healthy, supportive community. Seven, accessing quality trauma-informed medical services. Eight is repairing relationships with safe friends or safe family members. Nine, dealing with others who stigmatized or shamed me for being exploited or abused. And then number 10 was getting an education or job training. Now, when I say that it was number 10 on the list, there's percentages that the people said that the survivors said that they needed. And getting an education or job training was still 60% of trafficked survivors needed help with that. That's the 10th in succession. It's still like 60% of them needed that help. And then what was interesting is they asked them, what is your biggest needs now currently? I think anybody that was over 5 years out or something, the top 10 reported needs for them currently was number one, accessing behavioral or mental health services with providers that understand my trauma. Number two was accessing quality trauma-informed medical services. Three, paying off debt. for finding people I trust that care about me and could help me. 5, getting a job that is a good fit for me. 6, establishing or repairing credit. 7, managing chronic or long-lasting health issues. 8, accessing alternative therapies such as art, music, etc. 9 is accessing a healthy, supportive community. And 10 was dealing with others who stigmatized or shamed me for being exploited or abused. So what jumped out at me immediately was, I could sit there and say every single one of these, every single one of them.
Yep.
That was exactly like the same needs I had when I first got out. And yeah, although the percentages are way less, they're not like up in the 70s, 80s, 60s, 70s, and 80s percent that need help after the 5 or 7 years. It's still like 39% needed, want mental health help. There's all these babies out there just trying to deal with their trauma on their own.
Yeah.
Looking for help, looking for communities. That's why I'm excited about building a more inclusive community of survivors. From many different cults or any other type of extreme coercive controlled environment.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that are different for us than from traffic survivors, but some of the basic needs, those are still there at whatever level that we're able to access them or not. It's still there. They have a table here of the most valuable sources of support. And then a table of the most harmful sources of support. The most valuable sources of support at the very top was my own resourcefulness. 2nd is counseling and therapy. 3rd is other survivors. And then it goes on. And then I think way down, 9 was a faith community. Now, the most harmful sources of support, 1 top was an intimate partner. 2 was family. 3, faith community. So that's interesting. There's a lot of programs that churches want to run and stuff, but that's probably why that number is up there on the helpful list, but it's also way up there on the harmful list. I think we'd agree with that as well.
Yeah, for sure. I certainly do.
The barriers to achieving economic stability, that is something that they deal with. And I think all of us have had to deal with in a lot of ways, because that's one thing that survivors have. They'll come out of their situation that maybe they've been in since they were 12 or 13. And they don't have bank accounts. They don't have credit cards. Some of them don't even have identification. And so they're running around trying to do that as well, which is another very similar story that we've seen in ourselves that we've had to deal with. And it's been especially difficult in financial institutions, because there's the things you need to have a bank account. You have to have money to meet the minimum balance. You don't have a personal ID, so you can't open a bank account fees, all that type of stuff. It can feel insurmountable to the survivor, and they end up defaulting sometimes to the emergency services, which unfortunately, the more you access emergency services, the deeper you end up going down the rabbit hole.
True that.
Their conclusions, their findings was that the existing systems that are supposed to both prevent trafficking and support survivors are not working. And in every direction, they're confronted with barriers to achieving financial stability.
That's right.
But again, it's the same story that we face. You know, like, we're our own rescuers. But then where do we go from there?
Yeah.
That's the journey that a lot of us end up on and have difficulty with, have struggles with. I remember when we were here in the States, and somebody that we knew from Thailand, they had an American father, but they'd been born overseas because they were born into the cult. And then they'd had a child born overseas, and being able to get a citizenship for that child was like jumping through a million hoops. Mm-hmm. I remember trying to help with a few of the situations, and it was bad because parent can't be there to produce their ID to show that I'm an American citizen, which they can't, because in some cases they're still back in the cult. They're not going to fucking help you. If they don't have that, you can access school logs and that kind of thing. But for us, Where is that? I would have no clue where any of my relatives went to school, or actually, I wouldn't even know what city most of them lived in or state. I would be interested in doing a survey like that for us. What was it that we needed the most when we first left? What do we need the most now? Our current situation is. That'd be really interesting to see a study on that.
Yeah.
It's so weird that there's such a stigma out there about survivors, because almost to a fault, they're resilient. To a fault, they are resilient. Usually, if you need something to happen, ask a survivor, because that's the very nature of the way they lived, is in surviving. But people still get scared of the quote unquote big story. It's like that silence that comes into the room after you make a joke or you ask something about your friend's dad and they're like, oh yeah, he was murdered. Or he hung himself in my garage, and everyone freezes. And sometimes it feels like that when you're telling your story, whatever it might be, whether it was like actual sex trafficking, human trafficking, or coming out of a cult, surviving on your own. You try to tell people, they're like, I'm sorry, what? You remember that I was in that a business development group for a while.
Yeah.
And anyways, long story how I got involved in that and why I was in there, but it was so weird being in that group, because it wasn't just, there was a wide range of experiences. They were almost all, they're all wealthy women. I was the charity case, right? Like the kid that gets the scholarship to the private prep school. Like that was me. And anytime I opened my mouth to talk about anything, the response was, I don't know what to say to you. Of course, they always come back with the whole like, oh my God, you're brave, blah, blah, blah. But after a while, like, it's just, you don't want to hear that over and over again. You want somebody to say, doesn't matter where you're from, come into our community. That's literally what we're waiting around to hear.
Yeah.
And it's probably a lot like that too for people that have had tragic accidents or big losses or deaths or whatever, like some big tragedy, trauma. It's so common. Trauma is so common. One gets exposed to trauma at some point in their life, but everyone is so afraid of it.
Yeah.
So afraid of it.
Very true.
I read this thing the other day, and the thing that stuck in my head was, the healing is in the pain. And I was like, huh? But the point of it was that basically you have to feel the pain. You have to know the pain. You have to sit with that to be able to find the healing. But it is so scary. And everyone's like so afraid to go there. That's why we latch on to all these different things. Like, heal me this way, heal me that way. Let me focus on this. Let me focus on that. Whatever it is, we end up chasing, like, stroke the fairy walls. What's that movie? Get him to the Greek. Where she's like, anything can be your heroine.
Yes. Anything in the world can be heroine.
Yeah. And sometimes that's a little bit like what we do.
Yeah.
Whether we're pouring ourselves into a partner or a job or a project, or constantly running from having to deal with our trauma.
Anything not to hurt.
Yeah, I do it too. There's a few really keystone things that I would say was a big leap in my healing. There was lots and lots of little things for sure. And that's always been what I will tell anyone, is always focus on the small things, the little steps, the little ways forward. But there were a couple of big things that I was able to let go of. One of them was pretty much just surrounding my family when I finally realize, stop hoping or wishing or having any expectations whatsoever for their love, for their remorse, for anything. Literally drop them. That was fucking liberating. But the other one was letting go of going back to something. Now, I know we talk about, like, as kids born into a cult, we don't necessarily have a before our childhood trauma. But we came out, some of us with guns blazing, right? We just fought our way out, fought our way through. And there was our trauma when we were in the cult. But then once we got out, we spent so much time in survival mode over the course of the years. We faced different traumas and different things. We've told some of our stories. And so much of my focus on my life, actually, even though I didn't have a before, I still thought that I had to find it. There's this place that I have to go back to, like the innocence or the knowing, or there's this place I have to go back to, as in unlearning all the things that have been programmed into me. And while there's an element of that, certainly that we can do, when I finally was like, there's not a before to go to. And instead of trying to unlearn things, I need to learn how to live and how to thrive with who I am today, with who I am in this minute, this moment, right now. That's what I need to do. Those two were probably like some of the biggest, the kick burdens that I was carrying around in my healing that I was having a really hard time letting go of. I have no idea how we got off onto that. We've been talking a bit here and there with some of our other communities and some of the other people that we work with, and it's snowballing. Like this same voice, this same cry out of how can we help? What can we do? Not just for ourselves, but for those that will be coming after us. And it's chaotic out there right now, wouldn't you say? It feels chaotic to me. People are doing things that are important. Knowledge Center and the Countercult Coalition and the Safe Passage Foundation. But even within our own small community, there was all these like things, let's start this, let's start that. And all wonderful things and all very helpful things, but it still is, there's an element of chaos in there. What's the direction? Where do you go? And it's interesting because our parents were boomers, right? So we grew up with the boomer generation, and their story were out of the Vietnam War and the hippie era, where advocacy, and that was a huge thing. You could just go out there and be an advocate, and it was purposeful and it was important. But like we talked about before, what Yanya told us that one time, like you have to be healed to be able to advocate. Otherwise it's going to crash and burn. And yes, we see that over and over again, replayed over and over again. And I don't want to talk myself into a there's no solution mode, but we're this whole group of people that have spent or are still spending all this time in survival mode, just trying to scrape ahead. Or even if you're out of survival mode, you're still in a place where it's all you can do to keep your own personal shit together. And you can't advocate from a place like that. You just absolutely cannot. So how do we advocate for ourselves? Some people within our community, right, the Children of God, done amazing work by doing the TFI COG survivors that we're sending around a signature, but even just trying to get a signature. It's such a hard time, even just getting people to fucking sign their name to say, yes, Zerbe needs to be locked up and a horrible person and blah, blah, blah. Because it's so much to be an advocate. Not only do you have to have some of your own shit sorted out logistically, mentally, emotionally, you're going to wade into the problems. When you're an advocate, like you're pulling the deep galoshes on, and especially some of us that have come from deep trauma, we know what that means to have to go back there. We know what that means to have to see it in someone else. And it's absolutely fair of every single one of us to be like, yeah, nah. Unfortunately, we need more people to understand and know what we face as kids that were born in a cult. Because if you have people who understand it, a lot of times they can then turn around and become advocates. It's such a deep subject that it's hard to know where to go. That's where I'm at with this whole thing. Where do you go? Yeah, we can show up at the conference and be like, hi. We want to say that adult children born in cults need to, we need a voice. We need to be listened to. We need support. And then you're left to just hope somebody picks that up and agrees.
Peach agrees.
Peach definitely agrees.
Peach is like, yes, we need a voice. We need a voice. The needs of those who were trafficked are very similar to the needs of ex-cult kids.
And is there something that we can do about it on a bigger scale? Not just to help curb the suicide rate, which is awful, but right. Like what they did in fucking Australia. That kind of help.
Yeah.
That I would like to see.
Very true. Next week we'll be
digesting
some of the garbage that we used to digest on a weekly basis. Next week we'll be rehashing some trash. Not our trash, the COG's trash.
Exactly.
All right. Should we say goodbye to everyone?
Yeah. Thanks for hanging with us. Sorry about my voice. But yes, thank you for hanging with us and stay brave and always remember that every butterfly was once a caterpillar.
That's right.